I did.
Well, he's well, welcome to Lectionary Lunch. This is for, my gosh, I forgot to look up, about Pentecost 17, I think, if you're in the Lectionary series. And we're reading through Mark, as you know, this year, Series B. And we come to Mark 10 into quite a famous passage because it brings up Christ's teaching on marriage and divorce. Although I'd like to begin by saying that that is kind of a, to call this paragraph Christ's teaching on marriage and divorce is kind of a misnomer, because it's actually Christ's rebuttal of a phony Pharisaic question about marriage and divorce. And so I think it's really important for us to keep the context in mind, which will, I think, make Jesus' teaching clear. It will also make it harder than we thought it might have been. It won't answer any cases of casuistry. So I'm very sorry about that. But I don't think that's why our Lord gives us this teaching. But at any rate, it's following along here after Mark 9 and Mark 10, you get a couple of examples, further examples of the disciples' misunderstanding. So we'll pick up at verse 2, and the pericope system actually invites us to include the little incident with the children and go all the way through verse 16. So we'll kind of hammer through some of that material as well. So it begins, verse 2, and woodenly approaching, participle of pros erchomai, Pharisees began to ask, or were asking, it's an imperfect indicative from ero, ep ero tao, and so it has some sort of extra force to it, not just asked, but maybe began to ask him. And now A, of course, means if, and in an indirect question like this, it can be translated whether, so we'll translate it that way. They began to ask him whether, and now they're one of the Pharisees' favorite words, it is lawful. And in indirect discourse, it was lawful for a man, apolusai, to divorce his wife. And then Mark makes it clear that they're not doing this out of some desire to know God's will or something, but they're doing it to trap Jesus. This is a peirodzentes, is a present participle active, and following after the main verb asked here probably expresses purpose. You don't get many purpose participles in the New Testament, but this is, follows kind of the pattern. I think some, at least, of the English versions actually turn it into a purpose clause in order to test him. And, of course, they're not, they're testing him in the negative sense, so they're trying to trick him. And, of course, it's well known that there's a debate going on in Pharisaic circles in the first century. We have quite a lot of information about this particular debate, and it's apparently the case that the more liberal view of Hillel and his school is has gained ascendancy, so that divorce can be the means out of a marriage for a man for even the most trivial reasons. There's some evidence there in Josephus and also in the early material in the Mishnah. And the standard commentaries all mention this, and they're quite right. So this sets the scene, and again, I think it's important because they're assuming that their debates are valid debates, and they're trying to trick Jesus. So they ask him the question: what does he think about if it's lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus, of course, exposes their error because he wants to know where they're reading in the Bible, if I could say it that way. So verse 3, but he, answering, said to them, what did Moses command to you? The verb there from entelomai, it's a deponent verb, so it's middle in form but active in meaning. What did Moses command you? In other words, what part of the Bible are you reading? And verse 4, but they said, Moses permitted, literally, a book of dismissal, or a biblion, a writ of dismissal to write and to divorce, or to send away. And the passage they're referring here to, again, we know this because of the parallel material, especially, is this long sentence in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, which is not actually talking about valid reasons for divorce, but if you look at it and just read it, it's easy to see that this piece of Mosaic legislation is assuming that divorce will happen, and what it's actually doing is prohibiting a wife who has been divorced by one man and now divorced by a second from remarrying the first. So, but this actually became the passage that was central to this debate between the different Pharisaic schools. And the assumption is that, okay, if you want to know what the Old Testament says about divorce, this is the passage that you read. And what Jesus does, so to speak, is cut the hermeneutical legs out from under them. Because he says, in effect, in verse 5 and 6, you're reading the wrong Bible verse. So verse 5, but Jesus said to them, toward your hardness of heart, or in view of your hardness of heart, or in relation to your hardness of heart, he wrote, egrapsen, to you this command, the one that you've just mentioned. But that's not the real deal, verse 6. But from the beginning of creation, and now Jesus quotes Genesis 1 and then in rapid success in Genesis 2. From the beginning of creation, arson kai thelu, male and female, he made them. And then without pause, jumping right over to Genesis 2, verse 24. Henekin tuta, henekin is a preposition that we don't see very often. It's not uncommon in the New Testament. For the sake of this, or for this reason, a man, kata lepse, will leave the father of him and the mother. Just following, there's a lot of text-critical variants here, but none of them affect the meaning of the text too much. So for the sake of this, a man will leave the father of him and the mother, and proskale thesetai, this is from proskalaomai, again a deponent verb, and he will be joined. You can see the theta, eta, sigma in there of the future passive stem. He will be joined to his wife. And then the quote continues, verse 8, and the two will be literally into one flesh. Now that little prepositional phrase at the end, just grammatically speaking, is kind of a septuagentalism. And it's literally mimicking the Hebrew, the linking verb followed by the preposition la. Hayalah, normally just translated as the predicate nominative, and that's why our English translations say the two will be one flesh. So it's, I think, a very accurate rendering of a wooden Greek idiom that's mimicking a Hebrew idiom. And the two will be one flesh. And from this teaching in Genesis, again, What Jesus does is he essentially says to the Pharisees, your debates are completely wrong-headed because you're just looking for all the valid reasons or the valid means by which divorce is going to take place. And if you read that, it's interesting, if you read the Mishnah, there's an entire section devoted to divorce, and it's not all the material can be regarded as, you know, valid in the first century, but it's remarkably casuistic and focus on answering the question, what are the correct conditions for a divorce to happen? It's assumed that divorce is lawful under, and the only question is, how many conditions, under how many conditions is it lawful? Well, what Jesus seems to be doing is taking the notion of lawful and ratcheting it up and saying, what is God's will? If God's will is the law, and you're asking me about what's lawful, well, let me tell you, you're reading the wrong Bible verse. You need to be reading Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And then he draws a conclusion in verse 4 from that. Hosta, therefore, uketi, no longer, they are two, rather, and then just one flesh. So you repeat the linking verb. Greek likes to omit as many things as it can. As we all know. So no longer they are two, but they are one flesh. So that's the conclusion that's to be drawn from Genesis, and now Jesus draws a further conclusion. And it's so important to see that this is not, Jesus isn't pitting the Old Testament against his teaching. He's not pitting Moses against himself. but he's accusing the Pharisees of misreading Moses. And he simply says, verse 9, ha'un, therefore, relative pronoun, the thing which God sun edzuksen, this is from sun zugo, which means to yoke together, the thing which God yoked together, and now an imperative, which in kind of familiar archaic language, let a man or let no man put asunder, korizo. It's interesting, I didn't realize this. I was looking in Francis' commentary this morning a bit. This is actually one of the Greek verbs that's commonly used in secular literature for the act of divorce. So, but it's an imperative. It's a third-person imperative, which is hard to translate in English. We typically translate them, let a man not put asunder. But it's actually a command, so you could render it, I command that a man not do this. And that's the force of what Jesus is saying. So I think it's important to, both in Mark and in the Matthean parallel passage, to not overly complicate and not ignore and not soften what Jesus says here, because both passages come to a kind of a definitive statement here at Mark 10:9 and then the Matthean parallel. That is to say, it's never God's will. It's never lawful. Don't get divorced. And so in context, in historical context, Jesus is inviting the Pharisees, and of course they probably don't take his advice, but his own disciples, to a fundamentally different approach to the whole question. It's not assume that divorce is lawful and then ask her under what conditions. But Jesus simply says, don't do it. And by the way, if I could speak somewhat frankly, against the Roman teaching that once you're married, you're always married, if that were the case, at least in my estimation, verse 9 would be nonsensical. If you can't dissolve a marriage, then why would Jesus say, don't dissolve a marriage, don't separate what God has joined together? And so I think there's some confusion in that. I perhaps may be thinking about that simplistically. I mean, this text is so difficult, especially in our context, that maybe it would just be good advice to preach on the epistle or on the Old Testament lesson. But again, the answer to their question is it lawful to divorce? In the sense of, is it God's will and plan? Jesus says, no, never. And so we have actually sometimes come close, if not actually fallen into the Pharisaic mode of thinking when we say things like, well, there are two biblical grounds for divorce. That's the way the Pharisees think. And then we find ourselves doing silly things, at least I've heard silly things, where, for instance, if we have decided that there's two grounds for divorce, that is to say adultery, of course we get that from the Matthean parallel, Matthew 19, and then we run over to St. Paul, which we should, of course, 1 Corinthians 7, and if an unbelieving spouse deserts his or her spouse, then Paul says, let him go. And so we sort of collate these passages and say, okay, there's two biblical grounds for divorce. And then you have a wife who comes to you and she's bleeding because her husband's beating her up and he's threatening to kill her. And so then we say things like, well, that's really desertion, you know, or something like that. And I just fear that sometimes we in our attempt to kind of seek out God's will for marriage, we end up sounding a lot like the Pharisees. So the teaching is straightforward and simple. And when the disciples approach in Jesus, verse 10 to 12, I think Jesus' answer, he's not changing his mind. He's just repeating it in an extremely exaggerated and forceful way. So let's get verses 10 to 12 in. And this is a typical pattern, of course. The crowds, the opponents don't understand or they reject Jesus' teaching. And then in Mark, at least, fairly often he goes into a house and the disciples ask and Jesus clarifies also for them. So verse 10, and again, into the house, the disciples about this, they began to ask him. Notice it's the same verb form as the Pharisees. I don't know if Mark is wanting us to link the disciples up with the Pharisees. It could very well be, because they certainly don't seem to get or like Jesus' teaching. So they began to ask him, or maybe they continued asking him, verse 11. And historical present, he did say to them, there's a highlight here, kind of a small stylistic highlight from Mark. And now we get Christ's words to the disciples, hus on whoever, and because there's an on heading the clause, you get a subjunctive verb. Whoever, apoluse, aorist subjunctive, whoever divorces his wife and another aorist subjunctive, marries another. Now we get the main verb from moikao, commits adultery, ep autain, against her, probably to be translated against her, with her being the first wife rather than the second. It's possible, actually, to translate something like commits adultery with her. In that case, the autain would refer to the alain, the second wife. And we've tried to take kind of refuge, I think, in the voice of the verb, but I don't think there's any refuge to be taken here. I think Jesus is simply repeating the teaching of verse 9, but he's saying it in a more horrible fashion, if I could say it that way. So not only does God never purpose or regard as lawful a divorce, but even worse, if I could say it that way, he regards the action of divorcing your wife and marrying another as tantamount to committing adultery, which, I mean, we don't get the disciples' reaction here, but I can't imagine they were saying, thank you very much, and isn't that a nice teaching? And again, now verse 12, only Mark actually has this saying of Christ. It's greatly discussed and so forth, but Jesus actually just simply broadens the scope of everything and applies the teaching on the permanence of marriage to both husbands and wives. Verse 12, and if she, aute, after the participle apolousasa is an aorist participle active feminine singular nominative, and if she, after divorcing her husband, gamese alan, marries another, notice the shift to the masculine form of other, then moikatai, she commits adultery as well. You could add as well, I suppose. I suppose we should actually say a little bit about the children passage that follows. But I guess, and I always feel a little bit nervous about saying this, but I guess I think we should not regard Jesus' teaching here as covering every possible case of casuistry. He simply gives the divine revelation. The divine revelation is God's intent is for marriage to be permanent, one man, one woman. The patriarchs, you know, in some sense, might even have violated this by engaging in monogamy. As you read the patriarchal narratives, monogamy polygamy never turns out all that well. I mean, so it doesn't matter who the character is, Abraham or David or Solomon. Turns out worst of all, maybe. So here's the deal. Don't do it. It's never God's will. And I think we make a mistake if we try to find, okay, maybe there are some conditions in which it's okay. The answer is no. Breaking a marriage is like adultery to God. And but I just have tried, and I can't bring myself to think that Jesus intends to say things like, okay, let's say a wife's husband is having an affair and he wrongfully divorces her, but she can't get remarried because if anybody remarries her, then he's committing adultery. That's kind of a literalistic way of reading the Matthew passages. It's not mentioned here. Again, I think we make a mistake, hermeneutical mistake, if we say, oh, well, there are only two biblical grounds for divorce, but what if the wife is a drug addict and she's shooting up cocaine and then driving around in the car with the children? I mean, you could just produce these situations endlessly, and pastors have confronted these things. The fact of the matter is God never wants marriages to fail. He intends for them always to be permanent. And so I think you just have to deal with cases on a case-by-case basis. But our society and Christians in it certainly need to hear this saying, as the marriage ceremony says, marriage is not to be entered into lightly or unadvisedly. I know there are balances on either side of this one, but I kind of think it's not a bad idea to wait a while before you get married, as long as you can avoid severe sexual sin, because once you're married, you're married. I mean, and it's once you're married, that's a long time. We have a smaller than normal crowd here. We have two married guys. What summer did you guys get married, Bob? 75, yeah. See, so two guys who by grace have been married for a long time. And we both love our wives dearly, right?
Absolutely.
And it's a long time. You have no idea what's coming. And so it's only by the grace of God that you figure this out and you engage in the necessary forgiveness and confession of sin and all that kind of stuff. To preach this text in a law gospel way, to preach it in a way that's sensitive to people who have been divorced for a variety of reasons, and sometimes recently and sometimes long ago, to preach this text to single people, right? It's a great challenge for a parish pastor. I think that in preaching it, the pastor would need to hold up without apology. You know, this is God's plan, and when the plan breaks down, it's a terrible thing. And doesn't that remind us of just how we like to think that our sins, well, there's reasons for this or that, or whether it's divorce or breaking a promise or neglecting a child or whatever. Doesn't this text bring us to our knees so that if there is a marriage that survives and somehow brings honor to Christ, this is completely by grace. And if there are marriages that fail, it is a failure. It's not just that we didn't get along. I would pull out your gentleness here if you're going to preach this one, I think, especially in our context. Yeah, Bob?
If I might say, to always bring the gospel to these situations and the preaching of this text, I was reminded about how Jesus said, whosoever lusts after a woman commits adultery in his heart.
Right.
And the similar passages from the Sermon on the Mount where he's making plain to people that, well, you think you haven't sinned. You think you've kept the commandments, but you're not. You have sinned.
Right.
And here's another thing where, I'm guilty of sin, or we're guilty of sin, or we're in a mess. And that's when we need to bring the gospel, that the love of Jesus, God's Son, and the death of Jesus, God's Son, his blood cleanses us from all sin.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. So it's actually a good text, if I can say it this way, to be a Lutheran, who, at least in some sense, has been taught the art of distinguishing law and gospel in the school of experience. So that's a famous quote, you know. I think Abraham Lincoln said that, didn't he? Yeah, or Tom Jefferson, maybe that's what Jefferson said. So, but again, the teaching of Christ is clear, and the Old and New Testament agree. You know, Genesis 1 and 2, Mark 10, Matthew 19, Matthew 5. This is God's will. So, anyway, be gentle, and God bless your preaching on this. Maybe we'll just quickly get a few thoughts on the rest of the appointed text, verses 13 to 16. You could, if you wanted to link them together, and I can't imagine why you would, to be honest, and try to deal them both in one sermon. But it's just yet one more example of how the disciples are not thinking the things of God, if I can say it that way. So verse 13, and they began to bring to him, pros epheron, an imperfect indicative, children. Why? In order that he might touch them. Hopsetai is from hopto, and in the active voice it means kindle. In the middle, it means touch, and it takes a genitive direct object. So auton is actually the direct object of hopsetai, in order that he might touch them. And the disciples rebuked them,
in yet one more doofus move on the part of the disciples. Verse 14, and seeing, Jesus got indignant, agonakteo, and he said to them, aphata, this is from aphaemi, which can mean a number of things like forgive, permit, allow. And here it's the aorist imperative, active, second plural, you all allow the children to come to me. Me kolu ete auta, do not, or maybe stop hindering them, for of such ones, ton toi uton, is the reign of God. So the reign of God belongs to children. Verse 15, truly I say to you, Hassan, whoever does not receive the reign of God like a child, ume plus the aorist subjunctive, the no way Jose construction, as Dr. Veltz likes to call it, whoever does not receive the kingdom, the reign of God, like a child, he will certainly not enter into it. And after embracing them, en ankalidzo, after embracing them, kat eulage, another imperfect, he began to bless by putting the hands upon them. Now, maybe just one word, and then we'll stop for today, about this hos paideon, like a child. No, this does not refer to the faith of children. No, this does not refer to the innocence of children. No, it does not refer to anything other than the fact that children are dependent. They are helpless. They are needy. And children are of low social status. Now, in Judaism, they're cared for and loved, as opposed to some Greco-Roman context where children were treated more brutally or indifferently. But children are valuable in the ancient world because of what they will become. The famous verse from the Psalms, you know, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. If you keep reading the Psalm, the reason why the man is blessed is because his sons grow up to be strapping lads and they back him up in the city gate when there's a legal dispute. So in the ancient world and in Judaism, I have found, and I've never seen of anybody else who's found, a time when children are held up as a positive role model. But rather they're dependent, they're ignorant. To the Greeks, they're irrational, and they're needy. And that's what it means to receive the reign of God like a child. And it's, of course, the opposite of the disciples who find some sort of pretension in themselves and think they're too important and Jesus is too important to be bothered by children. Jesus says to them, hey, if you don't approach the reign of God, which is to say me, like a helpless, dependent child, then you won't even get in. And, of course, that's a lesson that we could all continue to learn. So again, it's two texts, and it would be, in my judgment, it would be difficult to link them. It's not like they're not connected at all, but, you could preach, I think, a wonderful sermon on either one. So thus far the gospel lesson and lectionary at lunch, and thank you very much.